This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Okay, I want to finally get to looking at the history of Sunday school. When we talk about Sunday school, we're talking about another import from Britain. Robert Raikes is largely credited with being, if not the actual founder, at least a pioneer in establishing Sunday schools. He has been called the Eli Whitney or the Thomas Edison of Sunday school. He was a citizen of Gloucester, along with another famous son of that region, George Whitfield, and about roughly the same time, a little younger. But he sat under, was exposed to Whitfield's ministry and the revival that it generated. He became a prominent citizen and businessman in the city and was the editor, owner and editor of the Gloucester Journal, the newspaper. So he was a journalist by profession. But he was concerned, especially with the needs of many children around the city whose parents were could ill afford to provide them with any formal training, any formal education at all. And he noted how particularly these children, these some were orphaned, they were lower class residents of the slums of the city, would particularly run wild on Sunday mornings. Okay, so here they are, have nothing to do on Sunday, and they're not getting educated anywhere. How do we put this together? Let's start a school, we'll call it a Sunday school. Begun in 1780, part of the mission of a local Episcopalian parish, and he engaged several women to teach these children how to read, and especially how to read the prayer book. This was the birth of a program that within 7 years would be so popular, it grew to enroll over 250,000 children. That was about 3% of the English population. And this was a wonderful thing that was universally has been universally credited to improving literacy in England in the early 19th century. It caught the attention of John Wesley. John Wesley noted in his journal, "I find these schools springing up wherever I go. Perhaps God may have some deeper and there." End therein than men are aware of. Who knows? But some of them might become nurseries for Christians. Nurseries for Christians. This is what John Wesley's vision for the potential of this little experiment by Robert Raikes expanded to the point where people saw this as the primary training ground for Christian young people. Wesley especially appreciated the emerging role of the laity in education. This was a vast untapped potential that was discovered. Raikes himself likely harbored more humanitarian goals. He was concerned about these children as the early victims of the Industrial Revolution, and he was thinking more of crafting simply a better life for them. It's Wesley who took this and really ran it into a more self-conscious religious direction. And before long, it hopped across the pond, and it was established in America, and it became in American culture the quintessential religious institution. It went from the English urban underclass to the American frontier. Here's a testimony to Robert Raikes in his native town. The American Sunday School Union was established in 1830 as an agency. 1824 was established in Philadelphia, it was. A key word here is union. Look at this early logo with the handshake. Protestants were going to cooperate together in the promotion of Sunday school, a challenge that became all the more urgent as the Western frontier opened up in the early American Republic. As a voluntary association, as a collaboration among other Protestants, it joined Sunday school, joined with other causes in the interests of promoting virtue and good citizenry in the new republic. You had the American Sunday School Union, you had the American Education Society, the American Home Missionary Society, the American Bible Society, American Tract Society, the American Sabbath Union, protecting the sanctity of the Lord's Day, the American Temperance Union, and you had, you had formed the American Anti-Slavery Society, at least north of the Mason-Dixon line. Indeed, this is not an exhaustive list. You had voluntary associations established to address every sort of public vice imaginable. It got to the point where one Protestant turned Catholic. Orestes Bronson lamented, and here I quote, that America would soon become a nation without an adulterer, a swearer, a Sabbath breaker, an ingrate, an apostate, a backslider, a slanderer. He said one could scarcely, a peaceable man in America today could scarcely venture to eat or drink, to go to bed or get up, to correct his wife, correct his children or kiss his wife without the benefit and sanction of a voluntary society. They were there to help with everything. It was almost exhaustive, the concern and attention that these groups had collectively. Now, and Sunday school was in the thick of this. Sunday school was almost the preeminent example of the success of what historians have called the great 19th century evangelical benevolent empire. And we might look at this nostalgically and think, there was an age, after all, when conservative Protestants were genuinely transforming culture, wasn't it? Would that we could reclaim this era today. We need to get beyond romantic notions about what's going on here and look a little deeper at what's going on, because there's something a tad more sinister about what's going on here. When you consider, for example, the Lord's Day societies like the American Sabbath Union, when you consider the American Temperance Union, um, where are those vices being expressed that these civically minded Protestants are trying to address? Where is the problem located? Who are the Sabbath violators? Who are the ones who are not able to hold their liquor and are becoming public nuisances? That's right. Who are not going to church? Where are these people coming from? This is Protestant, rural Protestant America trying to address the threat of urbanization. And urbanization is a problem being created by immigration. And immigration is a problem of these Europeans coming to our shores. A lot of them are Eastern Europeans, Italians, there's some Irish, a lot of Germans, and Jews. What these voluntary associations are doing collectively is preserving the Protestant establishment. And subtly, what's behind these noble causes is an interest to protect the cultural hegemony, the cultural domination of Protestantism. This is, remember, America has begun a few decades earlier under this audacious idea of religious disestablishment. And Europe is scratching his head. How in the world can you possibly form a republic without a state church? How can you cultivate virtue absent a state religion? It's surely going to collapse quicker than the French Revolution exploded. No, in fact, disestablishment was a key to the success of the American experiment. And why? Disestablishment worked de jure because it protected religious establishment de facto. American religious establishment had the effect of establishing white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. That point shouldn't be lost on us when we consider the rise of Sunday school. Let's take another example here. We talk today, you hear a lot of Christians today, cultural warriors among evangelical Christians, who are so insistent that American public classrooms post versions of the Ten Commandments on their walls. We always did that. Every 19th century school, public school, had the Ten Commandments posted there. Back then, we believed in biblical morality. Now we don't. But why did they post the Ten Commandments in American public schools in the 19th century? Or put the question differently, if you were a Catholic school child, and you saw the Ten Commandments posted in the classroom, what would be your first reaction? What would strike you about those things before anything else? Close. This is numbered differently. Lutherans would say the same thing. And you know what else? That's not the version I memorized. In other words, the Ten Commandments were another way of reinforcing to that school child who's running the country and under what terms you are going to become American. Americanization is Protestantization. If you're going to be an American, you've got to control your alcoholic intake. And you Lutherans, you beer-swizzling Lutherans in the Missouri Valley, you guys drink too much, and you don't observe the Puritan Sabbath. blue laws were established in the same way. We're going to regulate life so that the Sabbath can be observed, so that these immigrants will become genuine Americans. In other words, all of these voluntary associations, in addition to whatever virtues they sought publicly to promote, were about the task of religious warfare in the 19th century. They were establishing and zealously protecting the Protestant establishment. And part of that was the Sunday school movement. For that reason, Sunday school literature became increasingly and almost insufferably moralistic. Kids may not have gone to worship, but parents made sure that they got into Sunday school. It became an institution. From New York to Nebraska. And don't they look like they're having fun? You had the occasion, I hope you had the occasion to read the stories by Mark Twain. Did you read those? What's interesting about those, and what I found enlightening, he wrote those exactly in the style that a child would be hearing a Sunday school story. Only it didn't quite turn out right, did it? The child who never did anything wrong, he just couldn't prosper. And that mischief one, luck fell along his path at every turn. How could this be? Besides the humor in that, those stories are instructive because they give you a taste for how moralistic these narratives were. But it became an established institution. It became the epitome of American Protestantism, more than worship itself. What established the churches and their public presence on the Western frontier was their Sunday school hour. Now, so well established that what you saw by the 20th century, early 20th century, mid-20th century, a lot of folks wearing that little object I passed around. Now, who remembers seeing those things in their youth? No one else recognized that little object I passed around? What is it? It was a Sunday school perfect attendance pin. It didn't indicate that you went to Sunday school. It indicated that for the previous year, you had perfect attendance. Now think about that. Perfect attendance. Didn't people go on vacation? Well, not as much as we do. Okay, vacations were fewer and far between. But if you did travel, you were sure to do two things on the Lord's Day. Number one, you were sure to go to Sunday school. And number two, you were sure to go to the superintendent of that Sunday school and get a certificate proving you were there that you could give to the superintendent of your Sunday school, and thus keep your perfect attendance streak alive. Yeah, but this was truly a badge of honor. You didn't want to go to church without that, without proudly displaying how faithful you'd been. Here's another example of what we're talking about. And they could go really, really long. My wife and I subscribe to a weekly newspaper from Maine because we harbor delusions that we'll retire and buy coastal property up there. I know it's silly. But we like to read this paper. We go up to Maine every summer. It's our way of pretending we're still there. I came across this story from the Ellsworth American. The following church members of the Ellsworth Falls Church had perfect attendance for the fall quarter. And there are about 25 names here. This is newsworthy? What in the world? And then I looked. Oh, wait. This was the section. from 50 years ago. There is the story on the left. This was news. This is worth reporting. You're not only are you going to get a pin, you're going to get in the paper. Man, now who wouldn't want to get a pin, right? Who wouldn't want to get perfect attendance? Now, this is really a testimony, isn't it, to a bygone age? Sunday school as an institution, actually, in most parts of the United States, even antedated common schools that would become known as public schools. What happened when public schools were established? The effect of the public school movement wasn't to replace or diminish the role of Sunday school. It actually boosted it. And these two schools, these two institutions, would work in a symbiotic relationship in separate spheres. The common schools focused on literacy, while the Sunday schools were devoted to religious literacy. This partnership had at least a double effect. Sunday school was divested of its earlier original purpose of teaching literacy to the poor and the underprivileged, as in its birth in England. And common schools themselves, public schools themselves, would be a collaborator with Sunday school in turning these young tykes into good Protestants. Sunday school wasn't the only place where Ten Commandments were posted. As we said, they were posted in public schools, and public schools themselves would find subtle ways of expressing the established Protestant religion. There were some dissenters, including Mark Twain. One early Protestant group that didn't get on board was the Disciples of Christ. Now, you may be familiar with this group. They are Restorationists or Primitivists in the sense that they were founded on the principle of restoring as best one could the character of the early church. And you find, you search in vain in Scripture, in the New Testament, for any indication of Sunday school. So the founder of the Disciples of Christ, Alexander Campbell, a former Presbyterian, by the way, was fond of thundering that Sunday school was among the hobbies of modern times and one of the inventions of men. After he passed away, the disciples joined the bandwagon and practiced Sunday school as well. Another early critic was Horace Bushnell, whom we mentioned before. The advocate of Christian nurture, he didn't think Sunday schools, as they were originally designed, were effective in Christian nurture as he understood it, in part because Sunday schools were largely oriented towards evangelism. However, his views of Christian nurture would eventually prevail in the American Sunday school movement, especially among those of a more liberal direction. And so Bushnell, his influence, oddly, is now found perhaps most distinctively in the institution that he opposed. Bringing up Bushnell and the issue of Christian nurture raises the question about whether Sunday schools are primarily mechanisms for nurturing covenant youth or outreach evangelistic institutions for churches. And this is a question about which there's been an enduring debate in Sunday schools, and you have strong-minded advocates in both positions. It's an evangelistic witness. It's for our own covenant youth. And you get a lot of arguing back and forth about that. And also, you have folks trying to create some kind of mediating position among those two, trying to accommodate both those goals in the work of Sunday school. I do want to return in a few minutes to the issue of religious literacy, how Sunday school has been instrumental in cultivating religious literacy in America. But first, when we talk about this as the epitome of American Protestantism, what do we mean by that? Well, we're talking about several characteristics of Sunday school. For one thing, and part of the genius, no small part of the genius of Sunday school, was its effective mobilization and use of lay people. Sunday school became a way in which the laity would get involved. It was part of the democratic, it fit very well with the democratic impulse in American public life. This was a very empowering sort of thing. You have, all of us probably have cherished stories, those of us who grew up in the church, of that that senior man or woman in the church who devoted his or her life to Sunday school and was very faithful in the exercise of their gifts. You also had sort of a subset of this was Sunday school was an institution that called upon the gifts and talents of women in particular. If you are for or against if you are for or against women's ordination, you have an institution you can credit or blame for that, which is Sunday school. Sunday school was an instrument by which the movement towards women's ordination took root. A lot of a typical career path for a woman interested in Christian education in the early part of the 20th century would be to go to a Bible college or maybe even a seminary and get a degree in order to become a DCE. What is a DCE? All solid Protestant churches had DCEs. That's Director of Christian Education. A title that has disappeared largely with the spread of women the acceptance of women's ordination. Women don't have to stop at a DCE post. They can simply get ordained. You also had emerging developing a very romantic view of children in Sunday school literature. Before the Civil War, children were regarded as little sinners who could slip into hell at any moment. There was sort of a desperation that attached to the Sunday school efforts with regard to these little imps who were attending. After the Civil War and the emergence of the Victorian era, the image was changed. You hear the sometimes saccharine language about children as little sunbeams. These they are just the repositories of all of nature's potentialities and goodness. And these are things that we must allow to flower into full potential. But the 20th century as a whole has been a period in which this once sturdy and robust institution has gone into steady decline. What happened to Sunday school in the 20th century? In 20th century Protestant America? Well, part of what happened to Sunday school is what happened to the Lord's Day. What happened to the Lord's Day? Where was the argument? What argument can you find that turned Protestantism into a rigorously Sabbatarian Sabbatarian collection of denominations. Any Protestant denomination, Congregational, Episcopalian, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, was around 1900 firmly committed to keeping the entire day holy. To the end of the 20th century, or really by mid-20th century, you see the collapse of any Sabbath sensibility at all, except for small, extreme reform pockets here and there. Well, there's no argument. There was no theoretical or ideological revolution that took place. But what did take place? Well, what happened was Coney Island happened. Atlantic City happened. The Sunday newspaper happened. Professional sports happened. The automobile happened. All these things created outlets for Sunday activities that simply didn't exist before. And with the growth of Sunday as a day of consumption and leisure, the idea of keeping the whole day set apart for acts of public and private worship lost cultural plausibility. There's just too many distractions out there that would that got in the way of faithful observance of the Lord's Day. A similar thing is happening to Sunday school. It got lost in the busyness of a culture that increasingly saw the weekend as one run-on period of leisure activity. Some folks have argued that Sunday school ran off the rails when it got too professionalized. It became overwhelmed with the schooling instructional paradigm of doing business. It demanded, rather than rely on the faithfulness of lay teachers, it demanded advanced degrees of its administrators and its teachers. It got specialized. It got segmentized, segmented to the point where you had to have an expert train the youth or a specialist overseeing the small group ministry and things like this. John Westerhoff is he must be retired now, longtime professor at a spiritual formation, I think, at Duke Divinity School. And he's written extensively and very helpfully challenging the schooling paradigm or metaphor that attaches itself to Sunday school. You've heard of this silly riddle: when is a door not a door? What's the answer? Sorry. When it's a jar. Okay. Around mid 20th century, there was a similar joke running around Protestant liberalism: when is a school not a school? When it's a Sunday school, ah yes, that silly counterfeit that tries to be quasi-academic, but Westerhoff says this academic or a schooling metaphor is something that not just Christians but Americans tend to be addicted to. He writes, if people are killed on the highways, we add driver's education. If girls have children out of wedlock, we add sex education. No matter what the problem or the need, we organize a course. Schooling has become a panacea for all our needs. Of course, our schooling and instructional methods are continually reformed, but our faith in them is never really questioned. the schooling metaphor may have been plausible in an age when John Dewey was sort of the philosopher of education was unveiling his agenda in the height of America's progressive age. But it's really sort of it's now a fairly exhausted metaphor. And part of the problem with the metaphor is that we've seen some examples already. We talked about how silly it is that we have to conduct something like a promotion Sunday. We have to have truant officers who check to see if you're here or not. And if you're going to have a school, what's implicit with that is that you're going to have graduates. And one of the difficulties Sunday school has always had is encouraging adults to imagine that they should be attending. The prevailing attitude has always been, and it's even accentuated now, that somehow adults have graduated from this. Our authors of our textbook have an interesting footnote on page 156 that I want to read. One major concern that churches face today is that many adult Christians think they no longer need to learn and continue to grow in the way of the Lord. Many convince themselves that participating in corporate worship service once a week suffices for their life as disciples of the Lord, perhaps because they think they have learned all they needed to learn about God in Sunday school in their early years. It is no wonder that many adults in the church do not participate in the plethora of mutual teaching and learning opportunities, building one another up as fellow disciples of the Lord. It is also little wonder that the children and youth in the church are not acculturated or motivated to engage in the lifestyle of serious teaching, learning, and serving. Now, there's all kinds of reasons why an adult might come to that presumptuous notion of his Christian life and his need for discipleship, but certainly it doesn't help when he thinks of Christian education as Sunday school. In short, Sunday school has been associated with that famous line from the Hudsucker Proxy, you know, for kids. That's what Sunday school was, right? It was something primarily for kids. It really wasn't something adults should be taking seriously, committing themselves to. John Westerhoff goes on to describe that another contributing factor to the development of the schooling metaphor were the what he identified as the mechanical metaphors that were employed. In the early 20th century, he writes, the metaphor of an assembly line predominated. Children were valuable raw material, and adults had to take them and shape them into a particular design. Sunday school, then, was what parents did to children. Sunday school was how adults formed children. And they did this primarily through filling those kids with the necessary information and skills. By mid-century, the metaphor had changed a little more helpfully to the greenhouse. A child was a valuable seed that the teacher had to care for and nourish in the role of a gardener. Sunday school in this model was what adults did not to children, but for children. The ideal was to create a healthy learning environment, to provide resources, experience through which they could grow. There's still something somewhat ageist and condescending here. What Westerhoff welcomes is the metaphor of pilgrimage or journeying, a more biblical metaphor. Adults, like children, are growing in the faith, learning to come to greater maturity. This is a model that certainly encourages more intergenerational, interactive learning, and it sees Christian nurture not as what adults do to children or what adults do with children, for children, but what they do with children. They are learning together with children. These are all problems with the schooling metaphor that he has devoted his professional life to seeing to doing away with in notions of Christian spirituality, and he encourages us to think instead of faith as enculturation. He even uses the word catechesis here to describe this. I want to read this, reflect on this, because this is talking about catechesis in a broader way, and I think a very inviting way. It certainly includes all the things I would want to say about catechesis as we've described it earlier. Catechesis is comprised of two interrelated processes, formation and education. Catechesis always includes both converting and nurturing dimensions. We don't have to choose between evangelism and nurture here, okay? It also includes orthopraxis, right behavior, orthodoxy, right belief, it's head and heart. And he has these two principles, lex orandi and lex credendi, that we talked about. The processes of catechesis are understood best in terms of the circle of experience, reflection, and action. The processes of catechesis are related to readiness rather than time, to appropriateness rather than package formats. The end of catechesis is lifestyle, which includes our total being as thinking, feeling, willing persons. It is a personal pilgrimage with companions in community. You don't have to choose between an excessive, an autonomous individualism or a totalitarianizing communitarianism. It acknowledges the individual and communal dimensions to the Christian life. And it relates particularly to the liturgical life of the church. These are the insights of John Westerhoff that I think are quite inviting. One of the ways in which you see the schooling paradigm, people rethinking the schooling paradigm, there is even thought giving to renaming Sunday school. And churches have become fairly creative at times at coming up with other names for Sunday school under different terms. Here's a couple of things I've heard: discipleship hour, kingdom kids, morning instruction, Sunday communities, Sunday morning nurture. Now, it's just a term, school, but I think even finding substitutes for the term might be useful if our goal is to get beyond the limits and the restrictions of the schooling paradigm. You know, I remember, you go back a half century, I'm that old, before Saturdays became a frenetic activity, a frenetic time of taking your kids to sporting activities and other things, Catholics and Lutherans regularly would have catechesis on Saturday mornings. And that's unimaginable now, given the demands that parents have on their weekends. But, you know, Wednesday evening was a traditional prayer time in a lot of Protestant churches, and I know churches have successfully converted that or added to that an instruction time. Our Parrott and Kang talk about that. They talk about how in some cases small groups have replaced Sunday school for adults especially, and they do acknowledge that Small groups are a gathering for fellowship, and often they can foster accountability. But they worry, the authors worry about, are these occasions when there's any sort of a substantial teaching of the essentials of the faith? Small groups can devolve into uninformed, subjective sharing about what the Bible means to me. And their point is that the value of fellowship is by all means an important dimension of church life, but it shouldn't completely eclipse the role of edification. So when small groups take over Sunday school, you've gained something, but there's something of significance you've lost. I think their judgment would be to reserve, to try to build, not to build a small group ministry at the expense of the edification of adult learners. Sunday school has been on decline for beginning the latter half of the 20th century, a decline that's not coincidentally tied to the decline of the mainline in general. And you've heard, I'm sure, the jaw-dropping figures about how much mainline Protestantism is losing. It's losing identity, it's losing members, it's losing money, and Sunday schools are part of this hemorrhaging. Do we consign Sunday school then as simply a thing of the past? Many voices have pronounced the death of Sunday school. It was in the 1970s that Life magazine announced that Sunday school was the most wasted hour in the American week. 40 years later, Sunday school is still chugging along, and Life magazine is dead. Some have argued that this is an institution beyond saving. But Martin Marty, the eminent American church historian, probably put it best. He calls Sunday school a battered survivor. A Christian educator at Princeton Seminary, Campbell Wyckoff, says Sunday school is as American as crabgrass. It's always going to be there in some form or another. There are other practical reasons why churches are rethinking Sunday school. If you are planting a church and you're renting facilities, Sunday schools are expensive, aren't they? The more classes you rent, the higher you need, the higher your rent. And I would certainly insist, personally, that Sunday schools are not the sine qua non of a church plant. What you want to do in a church plant is establish worship. You want to develop a community by cultivating fellowship. As I see church planting, and I've been involved in some church plants, I would put Sunday school down the line in terms of the priorities that you want to establish in the life and witness of your church. By no means ought it to be among the first of your priorities. Now, with the demise of Sunday school, or at least the diminishing attendance at Sunday school, the increasing number of emerging adults who've never attended Sunday school regularly. And this is a phenomenon that will grow as we see demographically the growth of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, in American culture. You're seeing, at the same time, the decline of religious literacy in our country. Consequently, there are voices out there who are arguing for the restoration of Sunday school in some form in order to restore religious literacy. Simply put, Americans know less and less about Christianity and other religions. We know that the study of religion is being barred from the public classroom. Now, the conventional wisdom among liberals is that this is a good thing because religious sensibilities promote social conflict. A recent book by Stephen Prothero, who is at the religion department, teaches at the religion department at Boston University. The book is entitled Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. In this book, Stephen Prothero argues precisely the opposite, that religious literacy encourages peacefulness among different religious groups, and religious warfare increases under conditions of religious illiteracy. He himself claims to be he grew up Episcopalian, and he's now a he describes himself as a confused, non-church attending agnostic. So he has no particular theological or ecclesiastical axe to grind here. But he is simply stating what he thinks is a coming cultural crisis that owes in part to the decline of Sunday school. He has in this book an interesting literacy test that he gives. And let's take this test together. Let's just look at this. I'm sure we'd all do really, really well in this, at least in the Christian questions here. I forget the exact figures, but he has argued that Americans are scoring shockingly low in these sorts of answering these sorts of questions. Name the four Gospels. List as many as you can. I think the typical student can name two of these. Name a sacred text of Hinduism. There are many. That's one of them. Yeah. Name the holy book of Islam. RTS students should be able to do that. Where, according to the Bible, was Jesus born? George Bush spoke in his first inaugural about the Jericho Road. What Bible story was he invoking? That reminds me of something I saw once on David Letterman had a guest on. He had Tom Selleck. And Tom Selleck was telling some story, and he said at the end of the story, he said something like, "That was sort of a Damascus Road experience for me." And Letterman stopped him and said, "Yeah, I don't know what that is, but don't have one on the stage right now." Letterman himself did not attend Sunday school very faithfully, I guess. Name the first five books of the Bible. What is the golden rule? God helps those who help themselves. Where is that found in the Bible? Blessed are the poor in spirit. There are a few more. Name the Ten Commandments. Name the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. What are the seven sacraments of Catholicism? What are the religion clauses in the First Amendment? Ramadan, and then matching Bible characters with Bible stories. This stuff that would be no-brainers to at least the Christian portions of this exam to a Protestant youth in the early 20th century is now one that draws blank stares among many who are polled. I have a lot of favorite examples of embarrassing episodes of biblical literacy, but I think my favorite one was way back in 1980, during Ronald Reagan's first inauguration. And it was being covered on NBC by John Chancellor. And Reagan, at one point, there was a reading of 2 Chronicles 7:14. Now, it's bad enough that you're reading that at a presidential inauguration. Okay, we'll just leave that that problem aside. But just before it began, John Chancellor said, "And now Pastor so-and-so will read from 11 Chronicles." So his script had Roman numerals. He just assumed that this was the 11th book of Chronicles. That one, he let off that howler. Now, what are we to make of this? I think that the argument for the cultural benefits of Sunday school is really, in the end, a pretty thin reason for maintaining the institution. Prothero makes his case. It's sort of it's also an argument that reading between the lines, you see in the likes of Ross Douthat's book, Bad Religion, how we've become a nation of heretics. Douthat sort of makes the same argument that we are culturally impoverished. Because we're growing increasingly illiterate. These are, as much as, I'm not interested in seeing more interreligious warfare than anyone else, but there's something mildly, if you will, Constantinian about seeing the church become simply an instrument for the state. We certainly have got to have a more plausible argument for Christian nurture than these arguments, and let's not content ourselves with trying to make our Babylon a better place to live. As much as we're called to seek the welfare of the city to which we're called in exile, there is, to be sure, a better way, a better reason, a better rationale for Christian education. And we're doing this to serve in God's plan to gather and perfect that colony of heaven. It's Christian maturity that we're after. We're not interested in making better American citizens. Don't content yourself in your rationale for Christian education for something less than God's perfect plan for the growth of His people. This is what's at, nothing less than this is at stake. It's not simply making America a better place to live.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.